From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Midnight Bride. Assuredly, one of the strangest cases of continuous haunting by a ghost that was both morally and physically harmful is that of Sarah Pulgrane. It has been discussed by several writers in the past, but much of the information which I now give has never before appeared in print. The case is as follows. In the early part of the last century, there lived in the village of Ludvan, close to Penzance, a married couple named Pulgrane. It was the same old story, at least to begin with, that of a rather irritable elderly man and a wife with a good many years younger than himself, who, having long lost whatever affection she might once have entertained for him, was now in love with someone else. The pair was always quarreling. Sarah Pulgrane used to fly into violent passions with her husband, was often overheard to say vicious things to him and threaten him. There were rumors that she occasionally beat him, and that once, at least, she had jeopardized his life. Then came the climax. Sarah, very agitated and pale, came running into a neighbor's cottage one morning, crying out that her husband had been suddenly seized with what she believed to be cholera and was terribly ill. Later on, she again visited the same cottage, this time with the news that her husband was dead. At first, no one suspected anything wrong. The doctor apparently was satisfied that death was due to cholera, and a certificate to that effect was given. After the funeral, however, rumors of foul play began to circulate, and they eventually became so insistent that the local authorities decided to take action. The body of Mr. Pulgrane was exhumed, and on examination was found to contain sufficient arsenic to kill at least 3 people. Sarah Pulgrane was arrested and charged with murder. Now, this being a ghost book and not a work on crime, there is no need for me to go into the details of the trial. It is sufficient to say that Sarah was proved to have had a great hatred for her husband, and to have held many clandestine meetings with her lover, who went by the name of Yorkshire Jack. Some people said Yorkshire Jack influenced her, but in reality there seemed little doubt that she, being by far the stronger character of the two, influenced him. He was a good-looking, gay young spark, and Sarah appears to have firmly made up her mind that no one but herself should have him. The case against her was most damning. It could scarcely have been more so had she been actually caught in the act of murder. She was found guilty and sentenced to be hanged. So far, the case of Sarah Pulgrane is ordinary enough. We now come to certain unusual happenings that make it extraordinary. When the time for the execution drew near, executions in those days were conducted in full view of the public, Sarah pleaded that Yorkshire Jack might be allowed to accompany her to the scaffold. In some countries, such a request would doubtless have been peremptorily refused. But the Cornish, being exceptionally tender-hearted where women are concerned, it was acceded to at once, so that when the day of execution arrived, and the procession from the prison slowly approached the scaffold, Yorkshire Jack was seen striding solemnly along at Sarah's side. On and on the execution party came, till at last they had mounted the platform. Then, when everything was ready, Jack kissed Sarah. As the two stood clasped in each other's arms, Sarah was heard to say in slow, measured tones, "You will?" And Jack, after some slight hesitation, responded quickly and nervously, "I will." He then stepped away from her, but she never took her eyes off him, gazing at him with an expression of awful intensity till the very last. So much for the execution. Now, for one of the numerous stories of what happened subsequently. Close to midnight, a day or two later, a resident of Ludvan, tramping wearily home after a long day's outing in Penzance, was passing the churchyard when, simultaneously with the striking of the church clock, He heard to surprise the sound of digging. Wondering what could be going on at such an hour, as to his knowledge there was no immediate forthcoming funeral, he stopped and then entering the churchyard made for the spot from which the sounds came. He had not gone far before he saw in the cold white beams of the moon, which clearly illuminated every object around him, a tall figure in what looked like a white sheet with its back to him, busily digging on the spot where Mr. Pulgrane had been twice buried. The night was still, and the metallic click of the brain as it scattered the earth sounded loud and clear. Fascinated beyond measure, the man from Lugban continued watching the figure till suddenly a fit of coughing, which he could not suppress, caused it to straighten itself up and look around. The shock he then received was indescribable, for the white face that looked into his was not the face of the living at all, but the dead. Feature by feature, though the eyes were fixed and glassy, and the jaw dropped horribly, he recognized it at once. It was the face of Sarah Pulgrane. Round her throat, standing out in ghastly contrast to the appalling whiteness of the skin, was the black mark of the rope. For some seconds, he was too overcome with terror to do anything. He remained where he was, staring at the thing, his heart almost at a standstill, and his knees on the verge of giving way beneath him. Then, quite suddenly, his faculties seemed to revive, and he turned on his heels and ran, never once stopping till he reached home. Another incident of a somewhat similar nature involved a stranger to Cornwall. This man was riding along one night in the neighborhood of Lugvan, when, owing to the wind and rain, for there was a great gale blowing, he somehow lost his way and presently found himself in a lane full of ruts and holes instead of on the good main road leading from Penzance to Hale. Riding on as best he could, intending to ask his way at the first cottage he came to, he was making fair progress when suddenly his horse shied, and the next moment started off at breakneck speed. When at last he was able to regain some control of the animal, he glanced around and was startled to see a tall figure, swathed from head to foot in white, close to him, and with apparent ease, keeping up with him, although he was still galloping at speed. He tried to persuade himself that what he saw was due either to an optical illusion, to hallucination, or simply to sheer imagination, but reason asserted itself and he could not. Arriving at length alongside a churchyard wall, over which he could see the gravestones gleaming white in the moonlight, the thing suddenly turned, strode across the road, and approached the gateway. Impelled by curiosity, the stranger then looked back at it, and as he did so it threw off its hood and faced him. In the clear moonlight he could see it distinctly. Its cheeks were white, its wide open mouth drooped hideously, and as its eyes met his, they gleamed and glittered with a baleful light. It had long hair hanging in disorder about its neck and shoulders, while around its throat there appeared to be a broad black band or ribbon. Overwhelmed with horror, the rider put spurs to his horse and rode on. Almost immediately afterwards, however, yielding to sudden impulse, he drew up and turned in his saddle to take a final look at the thing before passing out of sight. It had disappeared, but as he paused, too fascinated for the moment to stir, over and above the moaning and whistling of the wind, he heard faint but quite unmistakable sounds of digging. Well, these and similar stories produced such panic in Lugvan and its immediate vicinity that, in the words of a local resident, no one dared venture near the spot, the burial ground, after dusk. There was, in or near Lugvan at that time, a well with a strange superstition attached to it, that no child born in the parish of Lugvan and baptized or dipped in the water of its well would ever suffer the ignominy of hanging. When Sarah Pulgrane was hanged, the people of Lugvan were greatly disturbed, fearing that the superstition or tradition had for the first time been departed from, an event which they regarded as a very unlucky omen. Fortunately, however, someone suggested that perhaps Sarah was not actually born in their parish, and a search being made among the parish records to the relief of everyone, it was discovered that Sarah had been born in a neighboring village, and therefore was not a native of Lugvan after all, at which, we are told, there was universal rejoicing. Now, to return to Yorkshire Jack. After Sarah's death, a marked change was seen in this young gay blade. Gone was all his gaiety and abandonment, and it was not long before he became sour-tempered and morose. His appearance, too, sadly altered. From being healthy complexion and well-proportioned, he grew miserably thin and ghastly pale, and developed a queer habit of constantly looking over his shoulder as if he thought he was being followed. A friend met him, so it was said, one wild rainy night on the beach at Penzance, and asked him where he was going. "Home," Jack replied surly, "but it is for the last time." "Why so?" the friend inquired in surprise. "Because of her," Jack said gloomily. "She gives me no peace. Wherever I go, she follows me. Wherever I turn, I find her at my elbow." "Do you mean Sarah?" the friend ventured, "or rather, Sarah's ghost?" "Aye," Jack said, "you've hit it. Walk along with me a bit, and you won't find I'm gaming you." The friend agreed, and as they paced along side by side in silence, presently there came the sound of footsteps and the tap, tap, tap of high heels close behind them. They could both distinctly hear these sounds above the breaking of the waves on the shingles and the moaning and howling of the wind. When they left the seafront and footed along the road leading inland towards Gouval and Louvain, the tap, tap, tap still followed them. "Do you hear it?" Jack declared. "Turn around and look." The friend was generally considered a reliable man of some courage, but when he got that order, he hesitated. There was something particularly unnerving in the tapping, and he was afraid of what he might see. At last, however, he steeled himself to turn around, and what he saw was not the figure of a person at all, but a peculiar bluish light. It was cylindrical in form and about 5 feet or more in height, and as it moved along the middle of the road, there issued from it the tap, tap, tap of high-heeled shoes. Yet there was nothing in its shape suggestive of a woman. "Well," Jack said, "do you see her?" "No," replied the friend, greatly disturbed. "I see no ghost at all, nothing but a light, and I'm thinking I'll be leaving you, for I can't stand being followed by it any longer." He made for a low wall as he spoke, and hastily clambering over, left Yorkshire Jack to continue the rest of the way home alone. That is to say, alone save for the tapping. The next day Jack went to sea, and a strange uncanny presence followed him. His mates used to see him constantly looking over his shoulder at something which they could not see, but at night, when they were lying in their hammocks in the forecastle, they were constantly aware of a strange unpleasant something standing in their midst. This went on for weeks, all through the voyage, and until they were almost within sight again of Mount's Bay. Then one morning Yorkshire Jack, who had been growing more and more restless and morose, made an extraordinary confession. Calling aside one of the crew, he told him he doubted very much if he would live to see another sunrise. "When I was on the scaffold that morning talking to Sarah Pograin," Jack said, "she made me promise on my oath that on this very day at midnight I would marry her. Thinking to humor her and supposing trouble had unhinged her mind, I agreed. But I now know that she was quite sane and much in earnest. Not being able to wed me in the flesh and blood, she means to bind me to her forever in the spirit." He whispered these last words with such emphasis, peering fearfully around him as he did so, that the seaman beside him felt his flesh creep and was completely unnerved for the rest of the day. That night, at close to 12 o'clock, the whole forecastle was awakened by the sound of footsteps. They were the steps of someone wearing high-heeled shoes, and they came up, tapping along the passage leading to midships, and halted beside the hammocks in which Yorkshire Jack lay, white as a sheet, his face contorted with terror. Jack got up, and without uttering a sound left the forecastle, and made for the deck, and the tapping went with him all the way. Once on deck, he walked straight to the bulwarks, and clambering onto them before his terrified comrades could sufficiently pull themselves together to stop him, he leaped into the sea. Just for a moment or so, those on board caught a glimpse of his white face amid the black billows, and then, before any help could be sent to him, he was swept away and out of sight. According to the statements of certain eyewitnesses of the tragedy, directly Jack disappeared, those of his mates who were leaning over the bulwarks, watching, distinctly heard, at least so they declared, coming apparently from the depths of the ocean, the faraway chiming of bells, a curiously ominous and sinister sound. They were undoubtedly wedding bells, but the marriage associated with them was one that could only have been made and sealed in hell. The Phantom Dotson. A haunting can be as much a source of worry as a distressing and puzzling illness. A person with an apparently unusual physical complaint, or one whose symptoms he would find embarrassingly difficult to describe to a doctor, will often keep his condition secret and suffer on in silence for as long as he is able. It is only when he is finally driven to confide in the doctor that he discovers his illness is not at all unique, that thousands of other people have suffered from it and thousands more will. So it is with a great number of hauntings. The witness involved will keep secret his alarming experience, very often believing that he must have been half out of his mind, until, to his complete surprise, along comes another absolutely independent witness, or even several of them, to offer personal corroboration of the same ghostly happening. Over the years, corroboration of hauntings has come to me in a variety of different ways, and one example of this is the case of the Phantom Dotson of a street in the West End of London. This began with a letter to me from a correspondent, Mrs. J. Piercy, as follows. Though I am by no means overindulgent to dogs, they generally greet me very effusively, and it would seem that there is something in my individuality that is peculiarly attractive to them. This being so, I was not greatly surprised one day when in the immediate neighborhood of B Street to find myself persistently followed by a rough-haired Dotson wearing a gaudy yellow color. I tried to scare it away by shaking my sunshade at it, but all to no purpose. It came resolutely on. I was beginning to despair of getting rid of it when I came to B Street, where my husband once practiced as an oculist. There it suddenly altered its tactics, and instead of keeping at my heels, became my conductor, forging slowly ahead with a gliding motion that both puzzled and fascinated me. I saw too that despite the heat of the day, it must have been approaching 90 degrees in the shade, the legs and stomach of the Dotson were covered with mud and dripping with water. When I came to number 90, it halted and, veering swiftly round, eyed me in the strangest manner, just as if it had some secret it was bursting to disclose. It remained in this attitude until I was within 2 or 3 feet of it, certainly not more, when, to my great amazement, it absolutely vanished, melted away into thin air. The iron gate leading to the area was closed, so there was nowhere for it to have hidden, and besides, I was almost bending over the animal at the time as I wanted to read the name on its collar. There being no one near at hand, I could not discuss the strange incident, and so came away wondering whether what I had seen was actually a ghost or a mere hallucination. Number 90, I might add, judging from the brass plate on the door, was inhabited by a doctor with an unpronounceable foreign name. Now, this curious little encounter on a hot summer's day would have remained in my notebook along with other interested single sightings, had I not then been fortunate to hear from another lady, a total stranger to the writer whose letter I have just quoted, about what, without doubt, was this very same phantom dog. Here is Mrs. S. Howard's story as she told it to me. I once had a rough-haired Dotson, Robert, whom I loved devotedly. We were living at the time near B Street, which always had a peculiar attraction for dear Robert, who, I am now obliged to confess, had rather too much liberty, more indeed than eventually proved good for him. The servants complained that Robert ruled the house, and I believe what they said was true, for my sister and I idolized him, giving him the very best of everything and never having the heart to refuse him anything he wanted. You will probably scarcely credit it, but I have sat up all night nursing him when he had a cold and was otherwise indisposed. Can you therefore imagine my feelings when he was absent one day at mealtime? Such a thing had never happened, for fond of morning constitutionals as he was always the soul of punctuality when it came to his food. Neither my sister nor I would hear of eating anything. While he was missing, not a morsel did we touch, but slipping on our hats and bidding the servants do the same, we scoured the neighborhood. The afternoon passed without any sign of Robert, and when bedtime came, he always slept in our room, and still no sign of our pet. I thought we should have gone mad. Of course, we advertised, selecting the most likely papers, and we resorted to other mediums, too, but alas, it was hopeless. Our darling little pet was irrevocably lost. For days, we were utterly inconsolable, doing nothing but mope morning, noon, and night. I cannot tell you how forlorn we felt. Then came the incident, which revealed to us the terrible manner of his death. I was out walking one evening when, to my intense joy and surprise, I suddenly saw Robert standing on the pavement a few feet ahead of me, regarding me intently from out of his pathetic brown eyes. A sensation of extreme coldness now stole over me, and I noticed with something akin to a shock that, in spite of the hot, dry weather, Robert looked as if he had been in the rain for hours. He wore the bright yellow collar I had bought him shortly before his disappearance, so that had there been any doubt of his identity, that would have removed it instantly. On my calling to him, he turned quickly round, and with a slight gesture of the head, as if bidding me to follow, he glided forward. My natural impulse was to run after him and pick him up to pet, but try as hard as I could not shorten the distance between us, although he never appeared to alter his pace. I was quite out of breath by the time we reached B Street, where, to my surprise, he stopped at number 90, and turning round again gazed at me in the most beseeching manner. I can't describe that look. Suffice it to say that no human eyes could have been more expressive, but of what beyond the most profound love and sorrow I cannot attempt to state. I have pondered upon it through the whole of Midsummer Night, but have not been able to solve it to my satisfaction. I do not know for how long we stood there looking at one another. It may have been minutes or just a few brief seconds. He took the initiative from me, for as I leaped forward to raise him in my arms, he glided through the stone steps into the area. Convinced now that what I beheld was Robert's apparition, I determined to see the strange affair through to the bitter end, and entering the gate, I also went down into the area. Robert had come to an abrupt halt by the side of a low wooden box, and as I foolishly made an abortive attempt to reach him with my hand, he vanished instantaneously. I searched the area thoroughly and was assured there was no outlet save by the steps I had just descended, and no hole, nor nook, nor cranny where anything the size of Robert could be completely hidden from sight. What did it all mean? I knew Robert had always had a weakness for exploring areas, especially in B Street, and in the box where his wraith disappeared, I saw a piece of raw meat. Now, there are ways in which a piece of raw meat may lie without arousing suspicion. But the position of this morsel suggested that it had been placed there carefully, and for assuredly no other purpose than to entice stray animals. Resolving to question the owner of the house, I rapped at the front door, but was told by the manservant, a German, that his master never saw anyone without an appointment. I then did a very unwise thing. I explained the purpose of my visit to this man, who not only denied any knowledge of my dog, but said that the meat must have been thrown into the area by some passerby. No one in this household would throw away good meat like that. He asked me to go away at once, or his master would be very angry, as he stood no nonsense from anyone. I had to leave. I had no alternative, for after all, who would have believed my ghostly experience? I found out, however, from a medical friend that number 90 was tenanted by an Anglo-German who was well thought of at a certain London hospital, where he was often occupied in vivisection. I dare say, my friend added, he does a little vivisecting in his private surgery by way of practice. But can't he be stopped? I asked. It's horrible that he should be allowed to murder people's pets. You don't know for certain that he does do this, said my friend. You suppose so, from what you say you saw, and evidence of that nature is no evidence at all. No, you can do nothing except to be extra careful in future, and if you have another dog, make him steer clear of number 90. I was sensible enough to see that he was right, and did not press the matter, and I soon noticed one thing, however. There were no more pieces of meat temptingly displayed in the box, so it is just possible that the occupier of number 90 got wind of my inquiries and thought it wise to end his nefarious practices. The stories of ghost dogs which have come my way are many and varied. Here is the strange experience of Mrs. Anna Sibuim. One Halloween, Mrs. Sibuim told me, I was staying with some friends in Hampstead, and we amused ourselves by working spells to commemorate the night. There is one spell in which one walks along a path, sowing hemp seed and repeating some fantastic words, after which they are supposed to see those people who are destined to come into their life in the near future. Eager to put the spell to the test, I went into the garden alone and, walking boldly along a path bordered each side by evergreens, sprinkled hemp seed lavishly. Nothing happened, and I was about to give up when suddenly I heard a pattering on the gravel. Turning around, I saw an ugly little black and tan mongrel running towards me, wagging its stumpy tail. not at all prepossessed with the creature, for my own dogs are purebred, and thinking it must have strayed into the grounds, I was about to drive it out, and had put down my hand to prevent it jumping on my lawn dress, when, to my astonishment, it vanished, literally melted away into fine air beneath my very eyes. Not knowing what to make of the incident, but feeling inclined to attribute it to a trick of the imagination, I rejoined my friends. I did not tell them what had happened, though I made a note of it in my diary. Within 6 months of this incident, I was greatly astonished to find a dog exactly like the one I have just described, but this time undeniably flesh and blood, running about on the lawn of my house in Bath. How the animal had got there was a complete mystery, and what is stranger still, it seemed to recognize me, for it rushed towards me, frantically wagging its diminutive tail. I had not the heart to turn it away, and so the forlorn little mongrel was permitted to make its home in my house, and a very happy arrangement it proved to be. For 3 years all went well, and then the end came swiftly and unexpectedly. I was in Blackheath at the time, and the mongrel was in Bath. It was again Halloween, but there was no hemp seed sowing on this night, for no one in the house but myself took the slightest interest in anything to do with the supernatural. 11 o'clock came, and I retired to rest. My bed was one of those antique four-posters hung with curtains that shone crimson in the ruddy glow of a cheerful fire. All my preparations complete, I had pulled back the hangings, and what was about to slip in between the sheets, when to my unbounded amazement, what should I see sitting on the counterpane but the black and tan mongrel. It was him right enough. There could not be another such ugly dog. Though unlike his usual self, he gave no demonstration of joy. On the contrary, he appeared downright miserable. His ears hung, his mouth dropped, and his bleared little eyes were watery and sad. Greatly perplexed, if not alarmed, at so extraordinary a phenomenon, I nevertheless felt compelled to put out my hand to comfort him, when he immediately vanished. 2 days later, received a letter from Bath and a postscript that I read that the mongrel, we never called it by any other name, had been run over and killed by a car, the incident occurring on Halloween at about 11 o'clock. "Of course," my sister wrote, "you won't mind much. He was so extremely ugly, and well, we were only too glad it was none of the other dogs." But my sister was wrong, for notwithstanding his unsightly appearance and hopeless lack of breed, I had grown to like that little black and tan more than any of my rare and choice pets. Miss Jean Prettyman, whom I met in Cornwall, told me she once lived in a house in Westmoreland that was haunted by the apparition of a large dog, enveloped in a bluish glow, which apparently emanated from within it. The dog, while appearing in all parts of the house, invariably vanished in a big cupboard at the back of the hall staircase. Miss Prettyman, her family, the servants, and several visitors to the house all saw the same apparition, and were more frightened by the suddenness of it coming than by its actual appearance. The theory was that it was the ghost of some dog that had been cruelly done to death, possibly by starvation in the cupboard. Some other ghost dogs do not make their appearance so startlingly obvious, as may be instanced by the following case in which I was concerned. A friend of mine, Edward Morgan, had a terrier called Scotch, which was found one morning poisoned in its big stone kennel. Soon afterwards, Morgan came to me and said, "Elliot, I've got a new dog, a spaniel, but nothing will induce it to enter the kennel in which poor Scotch was poisoned. Come and see." I did so, and what he said was true. Mac, the spaniel, when carried to the entrance of the kennels, resolutely refused to go inside it, barking, whining, and showing unmistakable signs of fear. I knelt down and, peering into the kennel, saw two luminous eyes and the distinct outline of a dog's head. "Edward," I said, "the mystery is easily solved. There's already a dog in here." "Nonsense," Morgan cried. "But there is," I said. "See for yourself." Bending down, he poked his head into the kennel. He then straightened up, looking at me very suspiciously. "You're having me on," he said. "There's nothing in there." "What?" I said. "Do you mean to say you can see no dog?" "No, because there isn't one." "Let me look again," I said, and kneeling down, I peeped in to see exactly the same animal shape and the luminous eyes. "Do you mean to say you can't see a dog's face and eyes looking straight at us?" I asked. "No," said Morgan, "I can see nothing." And to prove to me the truth of what he said, he fetched the pole, and raked about the kennel vigorously with it. We both then tried to make Mac enter, and Morgan finally caught hold of him and placed him forcibly inside. Mac's terror knew no limit. He gave one loud howl, and flying out of the kennel with his ears hanging back, tore past into the front garden, where we left him in peace. Morgan was still skeptical as to there being anything wrong with the kennel, but 2 days later, he wrote me as follows. I must apologize for doubting you the other day. I have just seen what you declared. It's been corroborated. A friend of my wife's was here this afternoon, and on hearing of Max's refusal to sleep in the kennel, she said right away she knew what was the matter. It was the smell. Max scented the poison which was used to destroy Scotch. She suggested I should have the kennel thoroughly fumigated and there would be no more trouble. While my wife asked her to go into the yard and have a look at the kennel, and the moment she bent down and looked and she cried out like you did, "Why, there's a dog inside, a terrier." My wife and I both looked in but could see nothing. Our visitor, however, persisted, and on my handing her a stick, she struck at the figure she saw. To her amazement, the stick went right through it. Then, and not till then, did we tell her of your experience. "Well," she said, "I have never believed in ghosts, but I do so now. I am quite certain that what I see is the phantom of Scotch. How glad I am, because I am at least assured that animals have spirits and come back to us." That incident happened at a country house. My next case occurred in the heart of London at the Old Motley Club in Dean Street, Soho. This club, sadly, no longer is with us, and was mainly for film artists. One afternoon, a few weeks before the club closed down, a film actor named Dixon, as he entered the premises, encountered a big yellow dog on the staircase. He threw it a biscuit from a packet he was carrying. Taking no notice of the biscuit, however, the dog walked by Dixon and descended the stairs leading to the ground floor. The next day, in precisely the same spot, Dixon again saw the dog. As before, he threw it a biscuit, and as before, the dog passed him by without taking the slightest notice of the biscuit. Thinking this rather strange, Dixon turned around to look at the dog, but it had vanished. Much puzzled, for it was not possible for the dog to have reached the bottom of the staircase and could not otherwise get out of sight, Dixon resolved to visit the club at the same hour the following day. He did so, and in the same spot encountered the dog. This time he threw it a small piece of meat, and on the dog taking no notice whatever of the meat, he aimed a slight blow at the animal with his stick. The stick passed right through the dog, which at once faded away into nothingness, leaving Dixon with his hair standing on end. Dixon told me the story himself and introduced me to another actor who testified to having also seen the dog. I learned from one or two other club members afterwards that although they had never seen the dog, they had sometimes experienced a very uncanny sensation when ascending or descending the staircase between the first and second floors. The case is not an unusual one. The ghost was probably that of a dog that had lived and died in the premises and whose spirit was tied to the spot through some deep emotion. More unusual, and in fact the only case of this kind which I have on record, is that told to me as a boy by an elderly friend of mine, Miss Nora Lefanu. Miss Lefanu told me she was walking one evening along a lonely country lane when she suddenly noticed an enormous Newfoundland dog following in her wake a few yards behind. Being very fond of dogs, she called out to it and attempted to stroke it. To her disappointment, however, it dodged aside and repeated this maneuver every time she tried to touch it. Finally, losing patience, she resumed her walk, the dog still following her. In this fashion, they went on until they came to a particularly dark part of the road, where the branches of the trees almost met overhead, and there was a deep stagnant pool. On one side of the road, the hedge was high, but on the other, there was a slight gap leading into a thick spinney. Miss Lefanu had never before walked this far along the road, alone so late in the day. She had been warned against going as far as the spinney, even in daylight. Everything that she had ever heard about it flashed across her mind, and she was more than once on the verge of turning back when the sight of the big friendly-looking dog plodding behind, reassuring her, she pressed on. Just as she came to the gap, there was a loud snapping of twigs, and to her horror, two sinister-looking tramps, sprang out and were about to strike her when the dog, uttering a low, ominous growl, dashed at them. At an instant, the expression of murderous intent in their eyes died out. One of terror took its place, and dropping their sticks, they fled as if the very salvation of their souls depended on it. As may be imagined, Miss Lefanu lost no time in getting home, and the first thing she did on her return was to go into the kitchen and ask the cook to prepare at once a thoroughly good meal for her gallant rescuer, the Newfoundland dog. She had shut the animal securely in the backyard with a laughing remark, "There, you can't escape me now." But when she returned to the yard, the dog had gone. This despite the fact that the walls of the yard were 12 feet high and the door had all been firmly shut. It was physically impossible for the animal to have jumped or broken its way out. The only possible explanation was that it was an apparition. This conclusion was subsequently confirmed by the experience of various other people who had encountered the ghost animal. And after exhaustive inquiries, Miss Lefanu eventually learned that many years before, on the very spot where the tramps had leapt out on her, a peddler and his Newfoundland dog had been discovered murdered.